Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
What's up, everybody? This is episode number 18 of the Master the Start podcast presented by GoMahi.com. We are excited because we have the one and only Steven Adams on the show today. This guy is an absolute expert in business, incredible expert in law, and he's a fellow at a university. I'm going to give you a quick summary of his resume, so bear with me because he's got a long one. He's done a lot. Hang in. First off, he started at Dorsey & Whitney. So he was an associate in the corporate finance department. After about 3 years, he moved over to Cargill and he was their senior attorney. And after being the senior attorney for 5 years, he went on over to the Cargill Financial Services Corporation. And so he was actually running Whalen Advisors. So this was a unit of the CFSC and an investment fund manager specializing in distressed companies and turnaround situations. They were doing so well at Wayland that himself and seven other partners, they went and actually bought out Wayland. They bought it out and he was one of the founders of Wyzetta Investment Partners. So this was started in 2004 and at its peak, he was managing over $8 billion. Crazy. So that would be a high stress situation. He was bought out by his partners in 2008. So great timing because it was in June 2008. That date is important. After that, he created Telemark Consulting and he has actually been conducting a bunch of consulting services for quite some time now in his free time because he loves it. He's also tested the venture capital world on his own. Absolute champ, super funny, super entertaining. I hope you love this guy as much as I do. So settle in, make sure you do me a favor this week. Please, please, please. None of you guys are doing me this favor. I've looked at how many people are subscribing and it is not many. So make sure if you're listening to this show, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, Google Play. I don't care where, just make sure you do it. And just love this episode of Master the Start. We'll see you in 2 seconds.
All right, Steve. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being a part of the show and joining us.
Great. Happy to be here.
Okay, so we always start with just the easy questions, obviously, because it's great for our audience to actually know what you've done, your background, you have a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I've done a lot of different things. I went to law school, graduated from Stanford Law School, worked for the Dorsey firm after that. This was in the late 1980s. Spent about 4 years there where as we were discussing, I worked with Howard Rudd, who's also been on one of your podcasts, but the same kind of practice that he did there, corporate financial practice, securities, venture capital, mergers and acquisitions. Then after I was there for a little while, I went to Cargill, where I was hired to work in the in-house law department. And my assignment there was to work with what they called the financial markets division. So that was my in-house client, which was great. Got to work on, there's a lot of securities stuff to work on, trading operations, securities trading, commodities trading, learned quite a bit more about commodities that I hadn't been exposed to. And then was working with a group there, at the time it was called Merchant Banking. The same sort of group, if you will, now it's called Black River, but it was like the Carvel. Black River is a different group that I worked with at the time now. But they were doing what I guess I would call distressed investing, right? And at that time, what that consisted of primarily was government through the Resolution Trust Corporation, RTC, was auctioning off the assets of failed banks or dividing banks into good banks and bad banks and auctioning off the assets of the bad banks. And so we would bid to win portfolios of loans. And I was working with the groups that did that. The first time that Cargill actually did that I was part of the team that pursued that and, you know, won an auction. We actually bought all the commercial loan portfolio of a San Diego bank-based bank called Home Fed. And so transactions like that over time, that business evolved to broader forms of distressed investing, investing in defaulted and distressed bank loans and high-yield bonds with the purpose of having some measure of control in the process or maybe eventual control of the company, perhaps using the bankruptcy restructuring process to convert distressed debt into the equity of a reorganized corporation. So private equity investing kind of manufactured through bankruptcy and restructuring. So I was there, and while I was there, I was offered the opportunity to just cross over from being on the law side to the business side. So joined one of the groups there that particularly specialized in corporate distressed investing, so high yield bonds and bank loans, you know, with a point of view towards having an active involvement in restructurings and equity ownership eventually. So I became part of that group for a number of years on the investing side. Got a lot of experience in that. Then ultimately, that group purchased the business in a management buyout from Cargill. And we launched it as YZ Investment Partners. So seven of us purchased that business. And so at that point, I was a founding partner of the private equity firm, YZ Investment Partners. Was there for several years, and then in 2008, actually, in this is very important, which month, in like June of 2008, amazingly, we actually closed on the transaction. As one of my partners at the time said, like a year later, like, wow, when we had that closing, we didn't realize there is a thermonuclear missile right next to our heads. I was like, yeah, you're right. But anyway, I took back a consulting contract and was also on the board of directors of two of the restructured corporations we invested in. So continued with that. Over time, I also wanted to teach. So for now, 10 years, I've been at St. Thomas. I sit at the law school there, but teach courses for law students and business students. And I do consulting for private investment fund managers primarily, and also do expert witness work in litigation involving private investment funds.
Wow.
So, yeah, sorry, it's a mouthful, but let's try to just lay it all out.
Okay, so this might be a super dumb question because I don't know a lot about this. How do you go from working under a large company like Cargill and taking seven partners and just buying part of Cargill and just going and doing your own thing? Like, how does that work? Yeah.
Well, that's a great question. Well, one of the benefits that we had is that in doing so, like the way there are other people, Cargill, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's like a great breeding ground, you know, the financial businesses there. And the Twin Cities are actually a really, you know, pretty happening place in the private investment fund world nationally. There's a lot of private fund managers here, and a lot of them got their start like in the chicken coop of Cargill, you know, and have, you know, departed over time and started their own businesses. There's several of these in town, right? We did it differently than most of them. Most of them have been either one person or maybe more often two or three people that have just, you know, decided, you know what, we're going to leave and start our own investment fund operation. As far as I know, we're the only ones who actually bought our business. You know, so we had already raised one substantial investment fund as part of Cargill. You know, we were subsidiary and sort of walled off in certain ways, but we were still 100% owned by Cargill. So we had a platform that already had one investment fund under management, which made it worthwhile to buy the business, of course, you know, because we bought the business that managed that investment fund. So we actually had streams of revenue in the form of management fees coming off that fund. And we also had the seven of us had basically, if I remember the number right, like 27 employees that were part of that business. And so we offered the opportunity to all of them to join us, you know, coming out the door in the new business we were founding. And if I remember right, I think it was something like 24 or 25 of the 27 agreed to do that. So from day one, you know, we had a total of, you know, low 30s people, and we had an investment fund under management. So we had the infrastructure of the business as part of what we got from buying the business, right?
Okay, so how about in layman's terms, can you explain why Zeta Investment Partners, and in layman's terms for our audience, private equity, what it is?
Okay, what private equity is, so structuring private investment funds. So what I mean by that, it's not a mutual fund, right? Like you or I or, you know, anybody can invest in mutual funds, right? So a private investment fund, it's kind of like a mutual fund in that it's a pool of money people have invested that's then managed by a manager. But it's a private investment fund because it now has like standards that people have to meet in order to be able to invest in it, standards of sophistication and net worth requirements in order to invest in it. And then you're in a different regulatory universe. You can do a lot more things that a mutual fund, for example, wouldn't be able to do. It's much more constrained in what they can invest in and how diversified they have to be, how liquid they have to be to meet redemptions, all that kind of stuff. So a private investment fund has much more ability to pursue investment strategies that are, you know, very non-diversified or unique, whatever, not liquid investments. And so private equity is within fund world. Private equity and hedge funds are sort of the terms of art. And if I was going to simply describe it, the difference, a private equity fund is basically a fund that's intended to have sticky money, as we call it. So if you were to invest with me as a private equity fund manager, what you're basically doing is saying, look, you can manage my investment for 7 years or 8 years. You as investor have no ability to call those funds back. They're with me now for 7 or 8 years. In a hedge fund, you would have some ability to, you know, get some of your investment back. And you know. So private equity is designed to pursue then investments that are not easy to sell, that might take several years. Yeah, but a private equity platform, you can actually make an investment where, you know, your time horizon is going to be like 3, 4, 5, 6 years of holding that investment in order to realize on it. That it's an investment that essentially the only way to sell it is selling a company, you know, which is not something you can do overnight, and it's not something that's easily done. But in a private equity structure, the virtue of it is that you could do that kind of investing.
Gotcha. Okay, so then why Zeta Investment Partners?
So why Zeta Investment Partners then kind of within that world of private equity? So it's very much Cargill DNA, right? Everybody came out of Cargill and, you know, learned a lot there. Learned a lot about like industrial and agricultural and commodity-based businesses, transportation businesses. So we kind of had that advantage and a lot of relationships that have been developed over time through working as part of Cargill. So it was helpful to us to have that kind of industry specialty. And we were within private equity, we were biased towards taking control positions. So we would make large investments in individual situations with the idea of having a controlling position. So
what is considered a large investment? I know you can't give a specific number. But
what I mean by that is, so a large investment would be allocating to like an individual investment position, something like, you know, $50 to $150 million instead of like 10 or 20 or something like that, you know, within the universe of private equity funds in terms of the investments you're going to make. So we made relatively fewer investments And so we were less diversified, but wanted to have more control over the individual investments that we made. It was kind of the trade-off.
So what did you find to be the most difficult situation or part of being in private equity?
Well, let's see. It's kind of stressful.
I mean, you were managing $8 billion. That's
well, at its peak, yeah.
That is stressful.
Yeah, well, and you have, there's high expectations. You know, investors are giving you a lot of, you know, control and authority over their positions, over their, you know, substantial investments. You don't always, are not always in a position to control everything that happens. You have to rely on a management team to run the company, and typically you'd have a board seat or be operating under that position. And on the other side of that coin is that it's very exciting too, but it's kind of a stressful business.
So do you think that's kind of the most difficult part, just the stress involved with?
On a very human level, that's kind of a difficult aspect. Yeah. It's also stimulating though.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the kind of person who, you know, can flourish in an environment like that is, you know, going to do well in it, right? But of course, the other hard thing about the business that's gotten harder over time is it's hard to raise the money. You know, like 2018, there's more money being sought by private equity managers than any time in the past. And it's become kind of a crowded space. Raising money from institutional investors is hard, and it's gotten more difficult over time. And I work with, you know, private investment fund managers now as a consultant, and I invest in various private investment funds. But I see them, funds managers who, you know, 10 years ago would have been able to raise investment funds probably without a great deal of difficulty, are having a hard time now.
Gotcha. So what are the fees?
The fees. So there are two fees that private equity, you know, runs on. One's called a management fee. And historically, you know, the management fee has been 2%. You know, the fees are called 2 and 20. The 2 is the management fee. So a 2% management fee. But as I was just describing, the balance of power in the private equity universe is shifting. It's shifting from the managers to the LPs, as they're called in the business, the limited partners, the investors. As more and more managers have been trying to raise more and more money, that's kind of a natural shift that's occurred. So now management fees are typically a little bit less than 2%. You know, it wouldn't be unusual to see 1.8, 1.7, even 1.5% has actually become relatively standard in terms of what the management fees are on assets. And then there's what's called the incentive fee. And in private equity, the way the incentive fee typically works is that you don't earn the incentive fee as a manager until you've returned all the capital that the LPs have put in and then make a profit on it. And typically, you have to make a profit of at least 8% cumulative annual return until you make any fees at all. And then the standard way that it's done is that after 8%, return, so you return all their money with an 8% annual return. Then at that point, you start to collect fees such that you're ramping up to 20% of the total profit. And the structure usually works that by the time you get to like a 10, 11% return, you've gotten to like 20% of the total. And then going, all the profits after that are typically split 20% to the manager, 80% to the LPs.
Okay. So when you talk about how you guys kind of worked, you'd invest more money into companies, and then would you take a seat on the board, or how would you guys be a part of that?
The interesting thing about a distress strategy is that when you're initially acquiring the investment, it's essentially being done on a hostile basis. And so that limits the ability to interact with management and to do due diligence. You have to do largely external due diligence, not internal due diligence, right? Because you're buying debt, you know, buying a distressed high-yield bonds or bank loans, then once you get into a position where you can restructure those investments into the stock of a reorganized company, then you can, you're in a position to negotiate for things like board seats or even control or restructuring and assign yourself, you know, board seats on a going forward basis. And then that's all kind of part of the turnaround, you know, strategy, then that you now have a seat at the table. The company has been financially restructured. There's typically additional turnaround things that need to be done in terms of its the businesses that it's engaged in, or efficiencies or things like that. And then as a director, you're in much more position to assist with and preside over that.
So typically, I'm thinking about, like you said, at the peak, you guys were managing $8 billion. So how many different companies were you invested in, and how do you, like, were you on multiple boards and giving a small amount of time to all of these companies or managers on boards?
Yeah, well, I mean, the point where you're getting up into like the, you know, $5 to $8 billion in investments, what it would have looked like is there would have been, say, like 100 investments, let's say. Maybe, and we divided them into control and influence and toehold, is what we call them. So of those 50 investments, yeah, or sorry, those 100 investments, you're going to have maybe 30 that are controlling positions or near controlling positions, and maybe like another 20 or 30 that are substantial influence positions, as we call them. And then the rest are toehold positions. We have a relatively small position where you're passive, essentially, and you may increase your position over time. You may not, but so probably have maybe 30 positions that are, you know, where you have some level of control and have the need to spend time on basically a daily basis, you know, monitoring those investments. We would probably be on, you know, among all of us at the firm, you know, 15, 20 boards at a time.
Okay. So I know you kind of touched on it, but what was your passion and love in private equity? Like, what was your favorite thing to do?
I was fortunate enough when I was in the law firm, you know, just beginning, got the opportunity. There was a lot of deals going, a lot of M&A deals particularly going on. And I got the opportunity to have experience in negotiating, you know, when I was very young. And I really like negotiations, especially complicated negotiations or multi-party negotiations. One of the funnest things in private equity for me probably was, you know, when you get to a point where, you know, you're working on a disposition of the company. You might have an auction or maybe not, but you're selling the company. So from a control position and realizing the returns on the investment, just all the negotiating process around that and maximizing your outcome from the investment, it's both. Yeah, it's going to be financially rewarding for your investors and yourself, right? You have the incentive fee, so you have the ability to maximize the return on that. But it's just a fascinating and fun process. What, you know, what I would kind of compare it to, use a Minnesota fishing analogy that, you know, we sometimes use, but you get to a point in the investment where it's like if you're like musky fishing, for example. But where, you know, you actually know, like, you have a fish. You know, you got to strike. You can feel it. You know, you can feel the fish. Yeah, you know, at the end of that, you know, you spent a lot of time learning how to do it and buying the right equipment, and learning how to use it. Maybe buying a boat. You got to figure out what lake to go to. And, you know, all this takes a lot of time and effort and money. You know, but you get to the point where it's, you feel it on the other end of the rod. Kind of what it's like when you're, you know, selling private equity investment. You know that the turnaround is working. You know you have buyers. So, and the negotiation, it's a little bit strained analogy, but it's a little bit like fighting, you know, the muskie on the line. You got to get it in. You know, you can't rip the lure out of its mouth, though. You know?
That's a good analogy.
It's a little bit like that. You know?
I like that.
It takes a lot longer, but it's fun, though.
Well, then, I know we already talked about it, but I just have to re-emphasize How do you manage a fund that large and not let the outside pressure of, like, basically being in charge of that type of fund and people's, like, hard-earned cash and being in charge of it having good returns? How do you deal with that? How do you go home every night if some projects are going poorly and just be like
that? Yeah, no, that's a good question. Well, one of the ways I tried to do it is I tried to keep my family life as separate as possible as I could, right? I had a wife and two sons, and which is great. It's another thing to be very absorbed in and involved in. And I really tried hard to, you know, leave it at the door. You know, that's that. You know, so there's times, you know, it's hard to sleep at night and stuff. You have to kind of try to, you know, struggle with that. But I really tried hard to keep the worlds as separate as possible, and, you know, to have a family like that, you know, is a very helpful thing. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Howard was talking about being a CEO and how all-consuming that is. And, you know, I think it really is. And, you know, for him, you know, the choice was, you know, not to have children, for example. And private equity, you know, it can become pretty time-consuming stuff too. But it's not necessarily quite the same as a CEO, you know, where it's really you, like, 24/7. You know, it's possible to at least have maybe, you know, some degree of refuge. You know, so there's that. And the other thing I think that worked great for us is it's helpful if you have people who have a sense of humor, you know, like in stressful, so among your colleagues. And so we used to joke around a fair amount and, you know, have a sense of humor about things, you know, to the best that we could. And kind of helps sort of take some of the tension out of the circumstances, you know, when you can do that. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing about the way some things, you know, go in the world now, where, you know, it might be possible to recover, you know, every email exchange or have recordings of, you know, what people are saying to each other. And when you take them out of context several years later and play them, you know, it's like, wow, these guys are terrible. <It's>, you know, that's really unfair, actually. And, you know, and under the circumstances, and people who have a sense of humor, you should be able to have some latitude to be able to, you know, have a sense of humor, you know, in the workplace, and particularly in stressful workplaces. I think it's a very important thing.
So are you guys sitting on cash waiting for the market to be distressed? Yes. Or are you raising when it gets distressed?
Well, the way private equity works is that when people invest with you, what they're doing is they're making a commitment. So, like, let's say I'm investing $50 million in Bobby's fund. So I'm signing a contract that says, I will invest $50 million when you want it, Bobby. You know, you tell me when you want it. And so you have these commitments. And so you're sitting there with those commitments, watching, waiting, trying to find the right circumstances. You can't wait, you know, and watch too long, or your investors get restless, you know, too. Because they have to, you know, hold back funds from things they could otherwise be doing to meet your call for the funds. But so as a manager, it's kind of that dance of you have all these commitments you've assembled, and so they're available. You can call them in a short period of time. You have access to large amounts of capital to make investments. But you want to do it at the right time. You don't want to wait too long. So that's kind of how it operates.
Okay, well then, now I'm just thinking from a investor's standpoint. So you're committing X amount of money for X amount of years. How do you know you're going with the right investment firm?
Like, yeah, so the way this works, like the primary investors would be like pension funds and foundations and endowments. So just understand what they're doing. So if you're managing like a pension fund, you know, obviously you don't want to take a lot of money and tie it up for 8 years, you know, with Steve and his friends and have that have a huge effect on your ability to manage the pension. So what you do is you create a basket. Usually it's called alternative investments. And that basket's going to be about 1% to 2% of your pension fund assets or your foundation endowment assets. And you're only going to make private equity investments out of that 1% or 2% basket. So private equity funds are the riskiest 1%, let's say, of like pension fund or endowment assets. because they're tied up, you know, and you're not going to be able to get them back. You now don't have control over that anymore. You've lodged it with a manager, which also runs back to kind of the pressure or stress point of it. Because in order to be able to take the 1% of the riskiest assets of a pension fund manager, you have to both promise and deliver pretty high returns. So you're looking at certain points in time when it was possible to get bigger returns, really looking at 20% plus annual returns. It's really what you're trying to generate. And at times in order to generate a 20% annual return, by the way, what you have to be able to do is you have to hit some major home runs. You have to have like outright doubles or triples. What I mean is outright doubling or tripling the investment you've made. You're also going to have some losers. When you're doing high-risk investing in control positions, there are going to be some times when things don't work, but you got to be able to cover that off, and still produce a high net return, especially when you have investments that last 3, 4, 5 years. 20%, 25% a year for 3, 4, 5 years compounds into, having to have some of those, outright doubles and triples. To quote, our lead manager of Vicente Investment Partners, he talked about a batting average, and if your batting average is too high, that actually is not a good thing, right? You're passing up on too many opportunities. Yeah, we tried to have a batting average that was something like 70%.
In that case, have you been a calculated risk taker your whole life? Or did you develop that skill of risk taking?
Great question. I'm probably a fairly small C, like conservative kind of person generally in my life. And but I do have something of an appetite, for like risk taking and within kind of bounded frames. Like for example, I really like to play poker and like do some gambling and stuff, but always in amounts that are not going to have any material effect on my life, right? If I lose everything, I'm still okay. And I also like, now that I'm investing for myself, right, I like doing some high risk, high return investing within my own portfolio. Obviously not all of it. You have to be conservative with a large amounts of it, right? You want to preserve the capital. But that's interesting because you can't be like a real kind of crazy ass person, if you will. It's an interesting task, to be able to, and actually this applies kind of to life generally, I think in a lot of ways. Ideally, in order to grow and to, when you see opportunities, come down the road, sometimes you really need to, pull the trigger and jump on those. And something I've kind of learned in this too, that, executing and taking advantage of being opportunistic. Maybe that's the way to put it. Being opportunistic is an important thing, and not being afraid to be opportunistic. And especially people that are younger too in your careers. And, when you see things that are opportunities, they don't come by all that often. And it may not be perfect. Taking a little bit of risk and pursuing those things, can be good. I mean, it's worked out for me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Right? I had an opportunity to leave the largest law firm in the upper Midwest, very stable place. I could have stayed there. I'd probably still be there and, doing just great. But I had the opportunity to go in-house and work in and it's still a big corporation, but you're part of a more volatile, financial investing business, and deciding to take up an opportunity that allows you to leave the profession, that you've trained for and have. I liked practicing law, actually. I didn't leave because I didn't like it. I liked it, but I liked this opportunity more. It was something that was very attractive to me, but not without risk. Yeah.
So with your personal investments, are you investing in companies or are you a part of that kind of investing?
With very poor success, actually.
Well, I'm kind of curious. How do you analyze that?
Well, one thing I kind of wanted to do on my own, I've described to you like this kind of distressed private equity investing, which is great. I love it. It works really well. It's a great model. But one thing we didn't ever do was we never did venture capital. right? And so once I was kind of on my own in a position to do some of my own investing, I decided what I really want to do is some actual venture capital investing. I want to see what it's like. And it also didn't look all that hard to me. Now, I've learned a lot. It's actually a lot harder than it looks. But so about 7 years ago, I decided I was going to do that and cast around looking for opportunities and picked one and ultimately participated in multiple rounds of a venture capital investment that I'm particularly thoughtful of now because like about 2 weeks ago, that investment, we filed for a free fall Chapter 7. You know, it's complete death. Complete death. I'm going to lose 100.0% of what I invested in this. But it was an interesting experience, and I spent a lot of time on it and got to see, you know, what looked like a very promising venture capital investment and see how that could go all the way to zero, how that could happen. And
will you do it again?
Not right away.
Okay, I could talk to you legitimately all day, but we should probably get to the quick fire questions, which sure. Really aren't super quick, but this is going to start kind of transferring to your teacher side because actually the first one is not because we allow our audience to give us one random question They want us to ask our guests.
All right.
So this one is ridiculous that we got this week. If you could wedgie any historical figure, who would you pick?
Wow, that's great. If I could wedgie any historical figure, jeez, wow. Oh man, yeah. jeez. You know, what comes to mind is, you know, I love the musical Hamilton. And you know, the way that Jefferson is portrayed. I would love to give that guy a wedgie, like Hamilton's Jefferson. Yeah, the guy's out of control. And I also have a big Hamilton fan from way before there ever was a musical. Yeah, I read the biography. And you know, his financial plans were critical to the development of this country. So I would wedgie his opponents actually at the time. But that's a good one.
That's a good one. I'm going to have to start using that more often. Okay, so you're an absolute business pro, adjunct professor. You love teaching.
I'm a fellow now.
Oh, fellow. Okay. Yeah.
Not to get into the titles.
Jeez. Yeah. Sorry.
I'm a wedgie giving fellow.
So we really focus on just all students of business. So what skills does a young professional need to have coming straight out of college to become successful?
Curiosity. Looking at opportunities and skill sets and knowledge and having curiosity, you know, about the we're in all the more rapidly evolving and changing world, and you have to have curiosity about that, you know, not be intimidated by it and pursue, you know, learning and understanding. Like a young person, because of that, actually, it's a time where there are, you know, more advantages like to being a young person in the sense that you can acquire knowledge about, you know, new things that your older peers don't necessarily as easily have access to. And the curiosity to do that and pursue that in substantive ways is huge. You know, historically, like in my era, you know, the primary thing that like young people had to offer, you know, to be honest, is kind of like a strong back, right? You know, the capacity to do a lot of work, right? You know, and within hierarchical firms, as the phrase was, you know, garbage flows downhill, right? You know, you have there's work that has to be done. And young people will do it, you know, and makes sense. It's worked for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And so you got to have a work ethic too, you know, willingness to understand that that's going to be part of the process, but curiosity and a work ethic, I would say.
Okay. I want to explore the work ethic part just a tiny bit because I believe my generation, 25, the later end of millennials and Gen Zs, they have an idea of work ethic in the sense where it's like, I'm going to post one amazing picture and I'll become an Instagram star, or I'm going to work like 40 hours a week and I'm going to become the CEO of a $1 billion company. I have a tough time sometimes thinking that that's the right outlook on work ethic. I don't necessarily think a lot of us have the understanding that some of you guys, when you say work ethic, you mean a lot of hours, a lot of stress, like just doing it in a way that.
No, actually, what I mean is something a little bit different. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. What I mean by work ethic is that is dedication to the tasks that you have to perform. That there's going to be tasks that are time consuming and have elements of them that are tedious, deadlines, and are going to cause you to have to forego some things you otherwise might like to do. That's kind of what I mean by work ethic.
And I think you kind of just touched on this, but the third question is, what do students of business, just or people really, have to give up or sacrifice to become successful?
I think it's really important to, you know, to have a family, yeah, to have a family life and children. So I would not say, although if you really want to go like to the very highest levels, like I respect the decisions Howard made, and you know that I kind of understand that, but so I wouldn't sacrifice that. That's number one to me, actually. I mean, like Howard said, you know, when your CEO job is number one, that's what you want your CEO to be doing, right? I get that, but you don't have to be CEO. You know, there's a lot of other things you could do that are very productive and amazing and engaging and fun and purposeful. And so family, to me, is huge. I would not give that up, and I would continue to have that be always priority number one. But you're going to have to perhaps give up, you know, some level of control over your time. And, you know, things that are worth doing well and worth doing hard. Especially when you're younger, you're going to be even more so in that position. I mean, I come out of the worlds of law and finance and investing, you know, it's fairly transaction driven, and there's a lot of work to transactions, you know, things like, raising a fund, securities offerings, mergers and acquisitions. When you're younger, particularly, if you're really going to learn about it and do it and be in the business, you know, you got to be there and be part of it. And they have a dynamic of their own in terms of the time that has to be dedicated to it over periods of time, and just going to have to be willing to accept that that's what life is going to be like at times, and be kind of opportunistic yourself too, and if that's the kind of world you're in, because there's also going to be times that you don't control, actually, where there's a little more downtime. You know, that's what's a little bit tough about it. I mean, everybody likes downtime, and it's nice to be able to plan it out. When you get to be more experienced and senior, you know, in these, you actually do acquire more of the ability to plan out, you know, your downtime. When you're younger, you typically don't have that luxury. So you have to kind of opportunistically seize the times when you're going to have more personal time and when that arises, and, you know, take advantage of that.
Cool. One last question. But before I ask you the final question, now I have to bring this up because we debated it at the dinner table. We debated if you were going to say finance or finance. And you said finance. Yeah. And we are curious why all the smart people, they say finance. And then all of us laymen say finance.
That's great. Yeah.
So is that actually the proper way to say it?
Finance.
Okay, so it's just like, okay, just like in real estate.
That's the way they pronounce it, I think, in New York and London.
Gotcha.
Copy of them.
So it makes sense. It's just like real estate when it's really, it's not a realtor, it's a realtor. That's really what it is. Okay, yeah. That's good. Good to know. Okay, final question before we kind of end this thing is, what is one life hack young professionals can do this week to become a little more successful?
Yep, great question. I knew you were going to ask it, so thought about it a little bit. So what mine is actually a mindset. And a mindset is a very important thing. So the mindset that I would encourage, so this is particularly for like I would say, young professionals, let's say. So not necessarily people who are entrepreneurs, you know, that's a little bit different thing. But I'm talking more now about people who are professionals. And when you're in your first or second job as a professional, what you really want to be getting out of that job is you want to be learning things, learning, you know, skills and knowledge about industries and practices and building relationships. And that's what you should really concentrate on. In fact, over the course of your career, the knowledge that you acquire when you're young, the relationships that you begin to build when you're young, those are actually worth a lot more than the dollars that you're being paid. You know, the dividends that those knowledge and skills and relationships pay, you know, over the next 30 years, are, that's huge. And if you're getting that out of your job, you may not be in the job you always want to be in, right? Probably not. Probably it's not your first job or your second job. It's probably not the job that you think, this is what I want to do forever. That's fine. But if it's a job where you are getting some, you know, knowledge, acquiring skills, having experiences, the ability to develop relationships, that is great. That is what you really want to be doing, you know, at those early stages. Now, if you have a job where you don't have any of those things, you got to get a different job. That's when you got to get a different job. But if you have a job, even if it's not one that you like, it's not the one you necessarily, you know, see yourself doing for long periods of time, as long as you have the ability to gain knowledge, skills, experience, relationships, that's what you really want to emphasize and seek positions where you can do that. And all those things over time will create opportunities, which kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, having an opportunistic approach to accepting risk in the forms of, you know, trying new things or taking on new positions. Those things all kind of flow out of those. And in fact, everything that I've done has flown out of relationships too. Relationships are huge. You know, it's helpful to network, but also just to tend to the relationships that arise out of your job and position. You know, I still have relationships that were formed, you know, 30 plus years ago. And a lot of those end up becoming really helpful over time and lead to things. And it's a mindset of maybe stepping back and thinking about those things and how you can, you know, get the most out of that, tend to that. That's a very important part of whatever job you have that's going to be benefiting you over time.
What a deep answer. Wouldn't expect anything less. So, well, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it. Just a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great. Really enjoyed it too. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks again, guys, for joining us this week on Master the Start. As I said, this is our 18th episode, which means I hope we're getting a little better at it. I hope you like our questions a little more. Let us know if you want us to change the format at all, because we're definitely open to making the podcast better for all of you. Some reminders quick before I let you go. Number one, have a sense of humor, find laughter in the good times and the bad. I can't tell you how important that is. I think that is awesome advice. You can't take your job too seriously. You gotta enjoy yourself a little bit. Secondly, this week, when you're in your first or second job out of school, your mindset has to be all about learning and relationships. This week, make sure you develop and internalize this mindset. So pretty simple things for you this week, but super valuable. And I'd even recommend going back and listening to Steven again. I just think his podcast was that special, had that much great information. I think if you guys want us to, actually either way, we probably are still gonna do it. We're gonna have Steven Adams back this summer and we're gonna start exploring that VC world a little bit with him. Hope you guys had as much fun as I did. And don't forget, subscribe to the podcast. We'd be eternally grateful because we wanna make sure we can keep providing value for you. So have a lovely week, everyone. We'll see you next week.